We are live.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Heathen Hour. If, as always, if you have any questions or would like to support the stream or the podcast, you can use the Streamlabs link that is in the description. We'll make sure those questions get asked and answered. And you can also answer or ask questions, I should say, in the live chat feed. If you aren't listening to it live, you can also listen to it everywhere you find podcasts. So on Spotify, iTunes, Fireside. And I am about to introduce our wonderful and special guest today. Our guest today is Jen, and Jen has a fascinating, interesting, really convoluted story that I'm excited for her to have the opportunity to share with you guys. But before we get into it, Jen, why don't you let people know who you are and where they can find you?
Hi, I'm Jen, of course. I was raised a Mormon and with Muslim family, so as a Muslim as well. I was raised a Sunni Muslim, which is one of the biggest group of Muslims. It's a sect. And I married into a sect called Deobandi, which is a sect of a sect, I guess, which was a lot more extreme. So I kind of fell into extremism and fundamentalism and became like not a very nice person. So I left Islam and I discovered that there was no God. And since then, life has been pretty good. And you can find me on Twitter at Murtad Millie. It's Murtadmilli. And that means someone who converts to Islam and then leaves, because technically I converted to Islam, left.
Your Twitter link is also in the description box. I've added it.
Yes, yeah, so everybody can go and find you. So there's a lot of interesting components to this story. I'm probably gonna have a lot of questions. So
was that lame or was that all right?
Oh, no, that was fantastic. It was good. Lame's a favorite. All right. You mentioned before we started that you also have cultural Jewish heritage, because the reason that your lineage was brought into the Mormon faith was because your grandmother was rescued from, was it from the Holocaust, from Nazi Germany, or from Poland?
From Poland. Poland? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you mind kind of giving a bit of a background of what role Mormonism played in your upbringing? Were you brought up strictly Mormon, or were you brought up Muslim, or was there components of each? Did you draw?
This is gonna get a little crazy, so yeah. Just bear with me.
Okay, that's fine.
I only found out recently that about my grandmother. This story, it was like the dirty family secret. It shouldn't have been, but it was because of the Muslim side. It's just not. It's not a good thing to have any kind of Jewish in you. I found an old baby book of my father's that had some water damage, and sealed the two pages, they were sealed together and glued. And I noticed from the water damage that it had come loose. So I found my grandmother's original birth certificate. And I'm like, what is this? And what are these names? And one of the names on there, and I can't say the surname because it's very unique, but they used to call me that as a child, and I never knew why. It was just like a pet name, and it turned out that that was my grandmother's original maiden name before she was adopted. So Mormons have a particular affinity for Jewish people because they believe that once you're baptized Mormon, you become Jewish, like your blood becomes Jewish. So they actually even tell you what part of the lost tribes of Israel you come from when you go through something called a patriarchal blessing. Usually around the age of 16, the patriarch lays his hands on your head and gives you kind of like it's kind of like a future reading of what's going to happen if you're faithful. So mine said that I was going to marry someone with dark hair, and I was going to have a bunch of babies, and I was going to get my own planet. It was cool stuff.
Yep. Everybody get their own planet anyway.
Right? Yeah. So the Mormon, my grandfather, my grandmother married my grandfather she was his second wife. He was a polygamist, and they were part of the fundamentalist LDS church. Whoa. And they had a compound in Mexico. Actually, in talking about this on Twitter a couple times, I've actually met some people that had family in the same compound, which is like, wow, small world. And he had, I think, 10 wives at any time. I stayed down there when I was very little. And for a long time, I didn't know. It's so sad. I didn't know that my grandmother was my grandmother. I thought it was the other lady. And so many years, I don't know. They actually mocked me for it for a long time because I didn't know that my grandmother was my grandmother. But my grandmother wound up running away. She got married, I think, when she was 15. And she had 3 kids and then ran away. And she wound up marrying this old guy just to get away, I think. And I remember seeing her off and on when I was young. But after that, we weren't really allowed to be around her. I think she was just like shunned. You know, that's a big thing in the LDS faith. Whether you're a mainstream Mormon or whether you're a fundamentalist, it's shunning is a big thing.
Oh my goodness. So you were raised more Mormon then? Like, where does the Islamic faith come in?
So I was raised mainstream LDS. My grandfather was a polygamist and a fundamentalist, but my father was the rebel, and he decided to go to the mainstream LDS church. So that's where that comes in. And on my mom's side, there's Libyan. And I was raised with her side of the family. So during the summers, we spent with the Muslim side of the family. And I learned, we went to like Quranic school and learned about like life. But I didn't know whether the plan was to make us Muslim or not. I don't think it was, because my father was pretty strict Mormon. But it wound up happening anyway, because I married one and fell into extremism, as I mentioned.
Did he have dark hair, though? That's
no, he was bald.
No.
So,
Mormons
so the Mormons couldn't have been more wrong. Yeah.
Right?
Mormons and their prophecies. It's bad in a thousand. So you deconverted from Mormonism to Islam.
Yeah.
So, and did you do it to get married or because it?
No, I did it. I did it before I was married.
Oh, okay.
A couple years before I had gotten married, I had gotten heavily involved with some of like my uncle and my auntie and the Muslims. Mm-hmm. And I think the plan, I'm going to be really frank. I was very overweight, very heavily, heavily, heavily overweight. And it was slim pickings for marriage. And Libyan men like women a little on the chubby side. Some, not all. So I had a better selection in front of me for marriage material. And I had been raised to just get married. That was the only thing I was supposed to do, was get married and make babies. So that was the only thing that I set out to do. And it just happened that I met my ex-husband online, of all places. And it was love.
So I had a question. I also wanted to thank Zal Rock on Demand for donating $10, and he said that, or he or she, I'm not sure, says J.A. Mirage is cool. I talked to her ages ago. Also, so when you were a Mormon and when you were a Muslim, did you actually believe in the religions, or was it more of like a community thing?
No, I was into it hook, line, and sinker pretty heavy. I believed whatever I believed in wholeheartedly, and I took it to extremes. Because I tend to do that. So when I was Mormon, I was as Mormon as you could get. I wouldn't watch a rated R movie. I wouldn't swear. I wouldn't, you know, heavy pet with boys. I wouldn't drink coffee or tea. I didn't even have my first. I didn't have my first cup of coffee until I was in my 20s.
Wait, coffee or tea? That's bad for Mormons?
Yeah.
Really? Why?
Yeah. it's against, they have, it's called the word of wisdom. So it's dietary guidelines, basically. No alcohol, no hot drinks with caffeine in them. So over time, it used to be sodas with caffeine, but now the Mormon Church owns some stock in Coca-Cola, so now soda's okay.
Oh, wow. Sure. Totally makes sense. So you converted to Islam before you met your ex-husband.
Yeah.
So what was that experience like, the experience of being a Muslim, both juxtaposed against being a Mormon and just in general for you as a woman in the Muslim faith?
It was easy because Mormons, the way women, especially as a woman, the way women are treated in the Mormon Church is you're a second class citizen. The men run everything. Even the women's groups are run by men. Women are not considered, you know, smart enough or strong enough to be able to run their own groups. So you can't get to heaven in the Mormon Church without a husband. When you go through the temple, there's a temple ceremony you go through when you get married, and it's to receive your endowments. And that's where you wear the funny apron and the silly baker's cap for men and the Mormon stuff that people laugh at in the temple. I took that very seriously when I went through. But I went through for... You go through for dead people as well. Oh, that's a long story. But as a woman, I didn't feel like I was losing anything by converting to Islam. The rules were pretty much the same. I couldn't make my own decisions. You didn't have autonomy. You know, your husband was the boss, and I was okay with that at the time.
That's what you're used to, probably. Yeah. That was your normal.
And anything different was terrifying. Just being, having that responsibility, and it really, really was scary. So I didn't, when I first converted, when you take the Shahada, that's all it is. You take the Shahada, which is, you just say there is no God but God, and Muhammad was his last messenger. That's it. And if you say that, you're a Muslim. And I started going to the local mosque and met wonderful people. And I loved every minute of it in the beginning. Kind of like the Mormons, it's milk before meat. They give you all the good stuff before they let you in all the bad stuff. Right. So there was a lot of events to go to, and they embrace you, especially if you have, oh, this is going to sound awful too. I'm going to say it anyway. If you have a British passport, which I have dual nationality, for Muslim marriages, that's a big deal. And it's not so much that, of course, everyone wants to live in America and the UK because they're great countries, but it's not even that. It's like, it's a selling point. It's kind of like they send their daughters to college to become doctors, but they never actually use the education. They just become wives and mothers, but it's a selling point. It's so sexist and it's awful, but it is. It's one of those things that just makes you more of a marriage material kind of thing. So
it gives you an edge.
Yeah, I was treated very well.
Wow.
So it was nice.
Okay.
At first.
Okay. When did things start to not be as nice, and what did that look like?
The Islam that I grew up with was Western. They had come to America in the 50s and 60s, and I have pictures of my uncle in the 70s with big afro and giant necklaces, like his chest hair hanging out and bell bottoms, and he's dancing. Mm-hmm. And I just laughed. It's so adorable. And they just wanted to be Americans, and they wanted freedom, and very different than the family and the Islam that I married into. And I thought it was the same. I was naive back then. So I had met my ex-husband, and I went overseas because I, because of the dual nationality, I stayed for a while in the UK, and then we moved to Pakistan, and that's when things went really terrible, was Pakistan. But in the UK, I was introduced to a family and beliefs that were very extreme, very homophobic, misogynistic, anti-Jewish, just there was rules for everything, literally rules for everything. Which foot you put in which shoe first?
Why?
It has to do with the angels, and like, you can't speak in the bathroom if you're naked because the angels will see you, and if the angels see you naked, they will curse you. Now, they literally really do believe in jinn, and kind of the evil eye kind of thing. What's the word for it? I've totally lost the word for it. Superstition. Mm-hmm. The superstitious part of it was hard for me to kind of accept.
What are jinn? Are they like angels, or are they just like spirits, like wandering spirits maybe?
Yeah, they're like, they can be good or bad, and they're not angels, and they're not demons. They're specifically made to be these kind of wandering spirit kind of things, but they can take the form of animals. And there's a lot of Muslims who believe that they can make people fall in love with them and possess them, and that's where the exorcisms come in and things like that. Well, demons can possess you as well, but yeah. And jinn can be other religions too. An imam, I've told this story on another podcast, but my parents had come to visit, and the imam at the mosque that we took them to told them that he had converted 10,000 jinn, and they were Jewish. He converted them all to Islam all at the same time. He spoke to all of them, and they decided they were going to be
he talked to all. He talked to all the invisible spirits, and they all told him that they were Jewish, and that they were, good work, guy.
And he was dead serious, and my dad's looking at him like, "What are you talking about?" I my dad laughed so hard, and I was so embarrassed. I was like, "No, you know, this is, the community is very close knit." Oh, that's it. So that, it kind of gets silly. It was silly to me. But the more I was in it, the more I kind of bought into the superstition part of it. It was weird. It's kind of, it takes over.
Interesting. So the more you were kind of embedded in that community and other people who did believe these things, the more it kind of had an influence on the way you perceived it. And it became a component of your reality as opposed to just, you know, a silly superstitious thing.
Yeah, like I really started to believe that there probably were jinn, and just that they made mischief.
Wow.
They broke things, and you know.
So you went to Pakistan with your husband. When you went to Pakistan with your husband, you said that's kind of where things started to go bad. What happened there, if you don't mind me asking?
Or go good, depending on your...
Yeah.
Well, we stayed, it was like it's hard to explain. So when you're in the big cities of Pakistan, you have the normal rule of law. The government, and they have, you know, laws that people abide by. When you go into the villages and parts that aren't, there is no normal rule of law. It's the village elders that make the laws, and that's where you have honor killings that are okay by, you know, and revenge rapes and things like that happen. So we stayed in both places. He had family. There's like the Punjab area, and which we spent a lot of time in. And then there's like the bigger cities like Lahore. I won't even get into it, but so we stayed in like big cities and then in village areas because he has family from both. And in the village areas, I saw a lot of horrible things, lots and lots and lots of horrible things. And I found out very quickly that I had no rights. Like, my passport was taken from me. I could have found my way to an American embassy or somehow called somebody. I wasn't as stuck as other women in situations like in Saudi when they can't get out at all. But it was bad enough that I acquiesced and I became the woman that I swore I'd never be. And I allowed myself to be treated like a second-class citizen. Like
property?
Just was okay with that. Yeah. And I was hit and you know, told what to do and raped on a regular basis.
Oh my God, I'm so
by my
sorry.
Husband. Anally. It's kind of interesting that there's such a stigma against homosexuality, obviously because it's one of the biggest sins, and you Islamically can kill people that are gay. But most of the women that I knew and sisters, you know, most of them, their husbands had a thing for anal sex and hurting them. It's I don't know what it was, but like for me, I was raped until I bled on a regular basis. And I went for help. This is why I bring it up, because I went for help and I went to go tell somebody and I was told that it was halal. I had no recourse. There was nothing I could do because it was allowed. And the only problem was that it was anal and that they kind of, anal's not okay. But I was still told that there was nothing I could do Islamically. And once that you're in a place where there is no other rule of law, there's nothing you can do. So even for that small amount of time that I experienced that, it changed everything, my perception of the world and relationships and religion and just I empathize and sympathize with the women that are in that situation so much more. Even though I was raised in a very misogynistic and oppressive religion and then married into that situation. And also when we traveled, when I misbehaved, I got sent to his sisters in Saudi. It sounds bad, but it was actually a compound where you had a lot of freedom. But I saw, like you actually saw people hanging.
Oh my God.
Gay people hanging. Like you saw beheadings, you saw horrible things, and it was like it was nothing. Like you drove past it, people walked past it, like
it was just run of the mill,
yeah,
day to day. This is just what happens. We're just killing this guy because we don't like the things he does. Carry on.
Happens to love a man, so you know we have to kill him. And it's so same thing for watching people get. I watched people get stoned.
Oh my God.
It just really, really horrible things. That small amount of time changed everything.
What?
And I mean, the small amount of time is a couple of years, but in the grand scheme of things, it, you know, I have PTSD now because of it. I don't know that you can go through that and not have PTSD, but.
I think anybody could.
That's the Islam that I married into. It was a different Islam. It was, the culture has so much to do with it. And it's a sect that is 70% of the Muslims in the UK are Deobandi. And it's a sect of like a break off of the Sunni sect. I think it's from the 1800s. And they're quite fundamentalist. And Islam is to the letter, and all the Quran has to be taken literally. There's no, you can't interpret it any way than it is. It's not like the Bible. So you have to follow it to the letter. Obviously not all Muslims do, because the world would be very different if they did. So thankfully, there's different people have different adherences and different belief systems that come into even the Islam that they are or the sect that they are. But it's allowed in the Quran to hit your wife. If you live under Sharia, you have no recourse as a woman. You can't go to anybody and say, my husband's hitting me. Then they say, well, what are you doing to make him angry?
Yeah, I've watched a lot of videos on YouTube that have like a Islamic priest explain why hitting their wife is a good thing to do. It's sickening. I'm really sorry that happened to you. It's horrible.
You're meant to be disciplined.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they explain it kind of like somebody here would explain smacking your kid, right? Like it's yeah, good to do. Yeah. You got to keep them in line. You got to discipline them so that they know what they're doing, and all that kind of stuff. So it's wrong in both cases. But
imagine how bad, like how powerless I was, and then imagine being born into that
and not being able to leave.
Like, yeah,
you at least had passports. There's two countries that you could go to where you had citizenship. If you are a citizen of that country and you're married and your whole family would keep you there too, you'd have literally nowhere to turn. You had connections at least other places.
Mm-hmm. So lucky.
If you had no connections other places, your entire family was there. Your family's raised in the same culture and thinks that this is okay, normal behavior. You would just have nowhere to go. And then if you flee the borders, you're stopped because nobody... Oh my gosh.
It also makes those women in Iraq, I think they're in Iraq, that are doing the dancing in the streets and stuff to protest. Iran, yeah.
It's Iran, yeah.
Yeah. Makes them look even more heroic because they have to do that in a culture and a religion that isn't making it at all easy to do that. I mean, you could just get beat for
some of the hours. Several of them have already disappeared.
Yeah, I can imagine.
They do it at the risk of jail and beating and sometimes losing their lives, and they know that, and they do it anyway. And there's very few people that face that kind of, you know, adversity and continue to fight back anyway, knowing that that could be their life. And they're so heroic.
Yeah. So how did you go from Islam to being an atheist like you are now? What was the turning point? Was it just your experiences in Pakistan, or was it something more than that?
Well, no, because in unfortunately, in the UK, there's a big difference between Muslims in the UK and Muslims in America. There's a giant difference. And a lot has to do with the countries that they come from and the sects that they come from. But a lot of bad things and a lot of the fundamentalist ideas that I had came from the UK. It came from the close-knit communities and the mosques. And there's also a lot of acceptance and allowance of hurting women in the UK.
Really?
And it's really bad. There's a place there. It's called Dewsbury, and people know it because of the grooming gangs that happened. But there, I went to go stay with a friend, and I was there for a couple months, and I didn't see a non-Muslim the whole time I was in this town. And most of the women had niqab on, so it was quite like it. Islamicized and quite fundamentalist, even for Muslim. I mean, in Muslim countries, most of them, the women don't cover their head unless they're forced by the government, or that's the only time that happens. Most Muslim women choose not to in Islamic countries. In the West, I think it's more their identity as a Muslim. They feel like they have to show that they're a Muslim. So they wear it more, I think, in the West than they do in other countries. But being around like this place where there was like no other people, what I found a lot of the times was women were being hurt and they would go to the police, and the police are also Muslim and also from the same community. They're Gujarati Indian and Pakistani mainly, and so they would send them to Sharia courts. And Sharia courts would do you know, you're going to reconcile with your husband. If he says he's sorry for hitting you, you're going to reconcile, right? And so they're pressured. And
why are there Sharia courts in a secular country? Why would police send somebody to Sharia courts in a country that has its own legal system?
They have that too. They have that in Canada as well.
Sharia courts?
Yes, they do. Yeah. They have to. So if it's only for, I should pull up the article, but I think it's only for some offenses. So it would be like fines. Like if you were to get a fine for something, it's not like for like murder or something like that. But
still also, shouldn't be separate anyway. We
don't it is separate, but both people have to. So say me and you want to go to the Sharia court. I have to agree if I'm the defendant, just say, and then it can be overturned by the secular court. So if I don't like the decision, I could go to the secular court. But the problem is that a lot of times, like,
women would be under duress, though.
Exactly. So exactly. Well, not just the women, but the men as well, right? Because they would be pressured by their family to go to the Sharia court instead of the secular ones.
It shouldn't exist.
Women would be more.
We shouldn't have two sets of laws in a. Nova Scotia, I'll tell you that much.
I think it's only in Ontario as well, if I'm not mistaken.
And they're not throughout the UK either. They only exist in a couple towns. I think there's 12 or 15 of them throughout the UK, and maybe there's more now. But it's also they do say that it's not legally binding. You know. So it can be overturned. So that's the selling point for it. And it's more like arbitration. So if both parties consent you absolutely as a woman are forced, you're staring at your husband and your family and they're all looking at you like you're gonna go back. Right. He says he's sorry. Right. So you go back and then it happens again. So you get introduced to a lot of negative things. And I saw and experienced so many negative things and it just got worse and worse, not just by Muslims though. I was attacked. My kids were attacked. My ex-husband was attacked by white British people calling my kids black bastards, attacking my ex-husband during the 7/7 bombing in London. He came home. He was almost killed in that bombing. He comes home. And the neighbors in the street attacked him and started beating him up. Wow. I got a bottle broken over my head, my hijab pulled off. I was spit on, called a paki lover. It's not just, it was ugly. It was a different experience. I never, ever knew that world in America. So when I walked away from it, I was still a Muslim and I was going to stay a Muslim for the rest of my life. But I had a conversation with a friend and it was that stupid pink unicorn discussion. He's like, I believe in a pink unicorn. I'm like, that's stupid. You can't prove there's a pink unicorn there. You don't believe that their pink unicorn is God. He's like, prove it. What do you mean? And I'm like, oh my God. It was literally like 5 minutes. It all just. When I hear stories about people's deconversion or whatever, but and that it's, you know, they studied. Mine wasn't. It was just like getting hit, like slapped across the face. Like
they just had an epiphany, like, holy shit. Wait a minute. It actually doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah, because that's the biggest thing, though, is that you can use the same logic that most Christians or Muslims use to justify their faith, right? For almost anything, right? Like you could use it for, like you said, the pink unicorn, or like I say, the pink dragon, whatever, right? Like just stick whatever you want in there. Bigfoot.
Yeah, the same justification and proofs.
It was just I happened at the right time, the right moment. I was open to it, I guess. Mm-hmm. And but you know, I was so cocky because the whole conversation happened because he said to me, he was an atheist. I'm like, ew, why would you be an atheist? What's wrong with you?
No, we get a lot of that, don't we?
Should have been hubba hubba.
Right? And so I'm like, I can convince you there's a God. And he's like, mm-hmm. I'm like, no, I can. I can prove it to you. And then he tells me about the pink unicorn. I admit it was it. I was just like, I hate you. You've ruined my life.
Did it really, though, or did it make it better?
Oh, it totally made it better. At the moment, I thought it was over, but... Because I've suffered a lot of loss in life, too. So a lot of that belief in God got me through, you know? Like, I was going to see somebody who died again, or, you know, all of that pain was for something. And then when that's gone, you're just like, you know what? I'm not going to put up with this shit anymore.
So you often hear, like, religious people say to atheists, like myself or Shannon, that try to convince people that God isn't real, that we're doing a disservice because we're actually ripping their belief away, ripping something away from them that's so important, that's like the central focus of their life. Do you think there's something to that argument, or would you say that it's, you know, a better, that it's better that it was taken away? Or do you think it's that you, in some part of you, maybe wants to go back to the, not back to Islam and being raped and all that, but I mean back to believing in something other than, like, in some kind of deity?
I spent this afternoon at a Methodist church decorating for some homeless families that they take in homeless families for a couple weeks during the Christmas season, and they stay. They have these, I guess they're dormitories or something. So we went shopping yesterday and got tons of decorations, and I really like doing nice things for people. That's a big thing. And there was a ladies' luncheon at the same time that we were decorating, and they asked us to participate. It was my daughter and some other family members, and they prayed, and I prayed with them, and was very, usually I'm kind of snarky, I was very respectful, because, you know, it's important that we're doing something good. And they actually fed us too, which was nice. But I found myself thinking, I kind of missed this a little bit. Then they started talking about Bible quotes, and there was some kind of sermon. There was like a little mini sermon. And then I said to my daughter, I don't miss this. No. I missed a little bit of the camaraderie and the family kind of atmosphere, but it's all contingent on you behaving a certain way. Hmm. And I guess society's like that too, but it's like you have to conform, and I'm really not big on conforming anymore. I went the complete opposite way. I'm just gonna do whatever I want to do.
So Zelrock had another question for you. He asked what you think about the term Islamophobia. Do you think it's a good word or a word that should be used?
No, I've been arguing this on Twitter recently, actually, because I'm very against using it. It's unfortunately, I think Islam is equated with the race. And so they say that, you know, Islamophobia is a form of racism, et cetera, et cetera. Islam is, there's entire countries of white Muslims. There's Muslims in every continent, in every country on earth. And not all. But so calling it a race is really unfortunate, because what you're saying is that whatever negative attributes you're putting towards that Muslim, that you're most likely you're critiquing that Muslim for some reason. You're making that attributable to a race. So if the Muslim that's an Arab and you're saying that it's an Arab trait to be a Muslim, that would be a negative thing that you're now attributing to Arabs. So I find it racist to do that. I don't know if that makes any sense. So you have to be able to allow critique of Islam. There's no Christianophobia or Hinduismophobia or Judaismophobia. There's anti-Semitism, because Jewish people, Semites, are actually a race as well. And there is no race of Muslim. There is no race of Islam. You would insult an Indian person, an Indian Muslim, if you called them a Pakistani or an Arab. You would insult an Arab if you called an Arab an Indian or a Pakistani. Like, to say that they're all one race is so, 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 so racist. So I'm against using it. I think that the better term is anti-Muslim bigotry, and I think that it is a real problem. I think that there are people just hate Muslims and don't like brown people. I think there are people that exist like that and want to do bad things to Muslims. And I think that hatred and bigotry for Muslims is a perfectly adequate term. But when you use Islamophobia, it shuts down people like me and other ex-Muslims and anyone that critiques Islam or says anything about Muhammad. That's a fact. Like, if you're very factual about Muhammad or Islam, then you're labeled a trouble, or you're an Islamophobe. So then you can be shut down. Right. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. That's usually what I think as well.
I'm long-winded. I'm sorry.
It's a way to stifle criticism too, I find, because if you, people are far more hesitant to attack the ideologies of Islam because immediately they're labeled as a bigot against an entire race of people, when Islam isn't a race, it's an idea, just like Christianity is an idea, just like Buddhism is an idea. You're attacking the idea just because people attribute that idea, biasly attribute that idea to a specific group of people in their mind. That doesn't mean that you're criticizing that group of people. It means that you're criticizing the idea, and all ideas should be criticism. Sorry,
I think there is something more to it in the sense that, say, in Canada or in the US or probably the UK, they're a very small minority of people, right? So I think that's where the I know it's kind of like LGBT people, right? Like they're protected because they're a small minority, and so there's like a big power dynamic there.
Are Mormons.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's true. Yeah, and Mormons as well. But I don't think like Mormons are as controversial. I mean, they're just kind of like, I think most people when they think of Mormons think that they're just kind of funny, like weird.
I think it's because it's also attributed to a skin color. It's attributed to, but you have a biased perception in your head. If somebody tells you and you've not seen them that they're a Muslim, there's a certain bias schematic stereotype that you have in your head. There's a stereotype that you have in your head. Mm-hmm. That's going to pop into your head. There's a certain type of image in your head. If it's a woman, you're probably going to picture somebody. Most people, if they're honest with themselves, who's Middle Eastern and in a hijab. And if they're men, you're going to picture somebody who's Middle Eastern if they present themselves as Muslim. So because you have to be honest about it, if you're going to address the idea, because people have that bias, they conflate it with people who criticize Islam, and that allows them to over attribute it to racism when in fact it's not, it's criticism of an idea, but that's how they get there, I think.
But I guess what I was trying to get at is like what you're saying is I agree with all that. But when
goddamn right, you agree with
but that. On the opposite side as well, like you would think when you think of a Christian, you think of a white person, right? Like
bingo, right? Yeah, but you can't be racist,
like, and so like but criticizing the majority is different than criticizing the minority.
Sure.
You see what I'm saying? So that's what I mean. Certain areas,
I'm agreeing.
Yeah,
because Mormons are white, so people aren't going to Mormons who aren't white, but for the most part, the bias that you have in your head when you picture a Mormon is a white person. Mm-hmm.
You
so,
couldn't even be a Mormon if you were black until 1978 anyway.
That's true story.
Very much,
that's true.
That's true. Also, the Mormon church is really, really, really bad for LGBT people. LGBTQ. Is it? Or LGBT?
Yeah, I think the Abrahamic religions or the ones that are kind of based on those are all pretty bad for LGBT in general.
They've actively, if you're the child of a gay parent, you can't be a member of the church until you disavow their relationship. And they actually used to teach, and they still do teach, suicide. That's why the suicide rate is so high. We were always taught, as girls, we were taught it's better to die defending your virtue than allow yourself to be raped. Regular basis.
Allow yourself to be raped?
Yes, because if you fought back, you would die fighting. So if you
didn't better?
Die fighting, yes. Better to come home in a pine box than without your virtue. That's 100%. It was regularly drummed into us. So they have taken that and without saying it outright, saying kill yourself if you are gay, it's kind of that same kind of thing. So the suicide rate is very high. So they're very...
That's why some of the family will sometimes kill the person that was raped, right? Like she'll survive it and then come home and then her family will kill her.
Yep. Because you... When it happened to me, not my ex-husband, but there's... it happened to me and I told my father and he said, you wanted it because you didn't scream and he didn't tear your clothes and you didn't get beat up. So you wanted it. So it wasn't rape. My own dad.
Wow. My God, I'm so sorry. You are a tough lady. Holy smokes.
it's like the alternative is not living anymore, right? You know? And it's like, so you got to keep going. But I think it's important. That's why I said I'm not shy. I'm very open about things that happen and the realities of the situation in both the religions and in the different cultures, because that my reality wasn't as bad, like I said, as a lot of women and men's and children's. You know, they have it so much worse. So it sounds awful what I went through, and I just got a taste of it. You know what I mean? Like it to think that what people go through and they survive and they thrive and they fight back. It gives me like strength. Do you know what I mean? Like to carry on and to keep speaking out for them. And like when I speak out against Islam, I'm very careful to say I'm not speaking out against Muslims. I'm speaking against the ideology because it's a totalitarian political ideology. It's very political. And it's the people are very different, you know, the different sects and the different, there are different levels of belief. And, you know, some are just cultural Muslims and, you know, so there's such a huge difference. And I love Muslims and they're my family and my friends and my loved ones and me. Do you know what I mean? Like I want them to find freedom and understand what it's like to have, you know, equal rights and human rights. And I want that to be introduced in every Islamic country. So I keep fighting and keep talking, despite being called names and a racist and an Islamophobe. And it comes with the territory.
I do have another question about, recently we've seen that the Women's March was being led by Linda Sarsour, who is a Muslim. And her and others, I've seen a lot of talk of it on YouTube. With Muslim apologists saying that Islam is a feminist religion. Is there some sects of Islam that you would consider to be some kind of feminist?
No.
That's just a flat no.
Just a no-no.
You know why they say that? It's because if you cover yourself up, the Christian Mormons are the same way. Modesty is a big thing. If you cover yourself up, you are taking power away from men to use you as a sexual object. That's why it's feminist. That's why it's the most feminist religion, because you are the most covered up. If you cover your face as well, well then you've taken all the power away from men. That's why.
Insane. that's what? Oh, that's what makes it feminist? Like if you hide yourself, you're taking power away from men.
Well, they'll actively say, I saw one, I think I've done videos on him actually, it's Muhammad Hijab, I think his name is. And he said that because feminists argue that they don't want to be objectified by the man's gaze, then if they cover up, then they won't be objectified by man's gaze, right? Because they
can't
see them.
That's not the point.
Right.
That's feminist, right? Mm-hmm. Also, under Sharia, women, they don't have to work. So you would be provided financially by your husband. Now the reality is most women do anyway, whether you live under Sharia or not, because I did and every other woman I knew did. But technically that's also works for you as a woman, and that is quite feminist because you could say I don't want to work.
So the ability to have somebody take care of you for the rest of your life, even though you're subjugated and subservient and have to cover up at least to a certain degree. That's a feminist idea.
Yeah. Also, you're not equal on Earth. They'll admit that men and women have different rules and it's not equal. But the equality comes in heaven, in paradise. So, because Allah has different expectations of the sexes. Women have different roles and rules because they're women. You know, a woman has to be treated differently.
Are there any rules, though, in an Islamic household, just say? Is there any rules that women would dominate, that they would be able to tell men what to do? Or no?
No. The husband is head of household, always. Now, okay. I would say in a Pakistani Arab, too, there's some really strong women. Some are spoiled, and men will, you know, kowtow, subjugate themselves a little bit when you have a man that doesn't want to fight back. So he wouldn't use Islam as his reason to control. That happens too. So you would have kind of a nasty woman that kind of tells her husband what to do. I had a neighbor like that. She was really mean. And her husband just said, yes, dear, to everything. So, you know, that happens too. But under Islam and under the law, it's the man. Always.
Yeah. But if shit hit the fan, he could legally go beat her up for being
mean to him. Yeah.
Wow. Jeez.
That's empowering.
Being beat up is empowering.
Yeah. They will argue anything is empowering for women because, you know, it's a woman, see, because women are not the same. Their brains are mush. Like men's brains are different than women's brains. So they have to be disciplined.
Where have you heard that before, Shannon?
They will be led astray. So, you know, beating, you know, hitting you, it's not, you're not supposed to hit her face. You have to hit her with a stick called a miswak, like a tooth stick. And you're not supposed to hit her to the point that you leave horrible bruises. But it's like a disciplined hit, you know, like smacking your kid. And you need that as a woman because, you know, Allah says that we need it. So it's empowering.
I had one more question, then I'll let Shannon. I've probably monopolized the questions. I'm sorry, Shannon.
No, I'm good.
But I'm just kind of fascinated by it. I lost it now. I lost it. I had it in my head. It just went away.
Gone. Completely gone. Maybe I need to take a stick to you.
I do. Allah would be right if you said I needed a good beating, for sure.
Somebody needs some subjugation around you. Oh my gosh. I have such a list of questions. I'm trying to figure out which is a good one because we've only got you for about another 7 minutes. So you...
Oh, I got it. I got it. Okay, I got the question.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I got the question.
Go for the love of God. Okay. Go before you...
So a lot of people say that we need to reform Islam. So it hasn't gone through its enlightenment like Christianity, and that reform is the better option. And then there's other people that say, no, we just need to drop the religion altogether. So they'd be anti-theists or strong atheists that say, no, let's just get rid of it. Just dump it. It's all bad. Which one would you say has the better chance of success? And do you think that the reform is worth doing? Or do you think that it would be the other way?
Do you know the word bidah? Have you heard that word before?
I don't think so.
It's a word. It means innovation in Islam. And it's one of the gravest sins you can commit. And it is reform. reform, because what I said about the Quran, it's literal. You can't reinterpret it any other way than word for word what it says. So to reform it means you have to say that Allah was wrong and Muhammad was wrong. And that is, you know, to say anything against Muhammad is punishable by death as well. So it's kind of a lost cause when you talk about reforming Islam. However, I think reform is possible because when you speak of reform, reform already exists. You have the Sufis, the Shias, the Deobandis, like the sect that I married into, and the more extremist terrorist groups as well. That's also a form of reform. They've just gone to the fundamentalist route instead of a more progressive, like Ahmadis. So you have smaller sects that would be considered reformed Islam. So it exists, but they are also in like Pakistan, Ahmadis aren't even real Muslims. They're not allowed to hold the same jobs as Sunnis. They're not considered, I think they're not even considered citizens, but they're not allowed to vote. They're not allowed to, they don't have the same rights as Sunni Muslims. So when you have someone that's like talking about reform and they're not from the same sect, so they're not a Sunni, and if they're speaking to Arabs, it's really important that they're an Arab speaking to Arabs. And if they're speaking to Pakistanis, it's important that they're Pakistani speaking to Pakistanis, because the differences in Islam between different countries is so significant. They don't listen. They don't understand each other. So in the grand scheme of things, yes, because it all comes from the Quran and they use the same hadiths, but the cultural, like the way it's practiced culturally, is very different, and they're very racist. There's a lot of hatred between, you know, the Indians and the Arabs and the Pakistanis and the Indians and Africans, and it just, there's a big cultural differences, and there's a lot of racism. So when you're preaching reform, it's important that you're preaching to the same sect. So Sunnis are not going to listen to someone who's a Ahmadi or a Sufi or Shia, because they consider them a heretic. They're an apostate. They're not a real Muslim. So I think in time there will be it has to be, because Muslims around the world now, with the internet and with social media, they see the way the rest of the world is living. And all you hear is the bad stuff, the extremist this, the extremist that. What you don't hear is the millions of young atheists in the Middle East in hiding. You don't hear a lot about the women, like the Iranians. Like, there's so many millions and millions of people that are pushing and pushing for freedom and autonomy and human rights. I believe it will happen. And I believe that it's just going to be a wave that goes through the Islamic world. But as far as a non-Muslim selling reform to Muslims, or a smaller sect Muslim, or just in general, the notion of reform, it is a sin, and it is punishable by death to innovate. So I don't have great faith in the word reform, if that makes sense. I just think it's going to happen naturally with the way that the world is going. So I hope that makes sense.
Makes perfect sense. Did you have anything to add there, Shannon? Any questions that you want to ask?
No, I think we covered a lot. I just wanted to say thank you for sharing your story with us. That's a lot to tell. And so confidently and competently and articulately, that it was wonderful to be able to meet you today and have a chat with you. I appreciate you taking the time to share your story with people, and also to let us know that it's very important that we don't attack people who are the victims of bad ideas, and we instead focus on the ideas so that we can help the people. So I appreciate your message here. Did you have any parting words, as we have about a minute left before, because we took you away from your vacation. God bless your heart.
What a thing. Oh, I'm kind of sick of my family now anyway.
Oh, that's fair.
We're going to be going home tomorrow, so I was kind of excited. I do love them, but it's been... my daughter came out, because we've been spending time with a Muslim family, and my daughter came out, so it's been very emotional.
Oh, came out
as lesbian.
Oh my gosh, wow.
Yeah, so I knew, but like the rest of the family didn't, so they didn't have a good reaction to it.
Oh no.
Yeah, it's been a little interesting. Some were fine, but some didn't.
She has you to support though, so that's great.
Yeah. And so it's that's what I'm kind of ready to go home.
Yeah.
But I'm so glad that you heard, you know, that it's important that the people are protected, and those people in just a little while could be not, they don't have to leave Islam to be like ex-Muslims, or they don't to be progressive, or you know, to want human rights for everyone. It's not that they have to drop Islam. It's just so important to not attack them for the ideas, and a lot of people want to, and they don't understand when I say that. Like, yes, they are the same sort of, but the people are not the ideas and the ideology. So it's just, it's very important. So I'm so glad that you said that. Like that makes my heart happy.
It's one of our messages, really. I think we both try to push that message. Although I do draw a line and say that there are, people have to carry out the bad ideas. So at some level, they're responsible. But
you can't unilaterally attack a group of people because they're a member of an overall innocuous. Yeah,
obviously they're a very diverse group, right? Like if you took any large group, there would be some people that are good and some people that aren't so good. So definitely. Thank you very much for... I just want to echo what Shannon said there. Very brave, and your story's... I don't want to say heartwarming because it's not in that way. In that way, you know what I mean? But I mean, it's amazing to hear somebody like you be so strong in the face of that. So thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on. It was fun. We should do it again.
We should definitely do it again.
I'm sure we can think of more questions.
Definitely.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Bye, chat. Thanks, chat. See you guys later.
Bye.